can forgive me.
Okay.
Yes, I write about the intersections of art and science quite frequently, but it's within a relative cul-de-sac. So it's a real privilege today to be able to kind of share these thoughts with artists and scientists together. I kind of came across Joe's work initially whilst researching a paper for Art Monthly. It was an essay on the Anthropocene, which is the term that Marco introduced earlier. And I had a few kind of problems with the idea of the Anthropocene in terms of the way that it pitched a certain idea of the human, a very kind of simple idea of the human as a point from which we could kind of rally an environmental kind of campaign or response to the impact that kind of big business was having on the environment. And part of the kind of research that came out of that was this kind of realization that the Anthropocene as a concept needed to be sort of broken down a bit and be differentiated and made kind of open to different communities that maybe weren't able to access the term human or the kind of subject position of the human that the Anthropocene was fairly complacent about. And one of the kind of main themes that came out of that research was the idea of hybridity and contamination and the way that the kind of centered human subject could be rethought through different ideas of kind of porosity or permeability, and the idea that our bodies aren't kind of hermetic structures, but things that are open to influences from the kind of wider environment. And so just taking that idea of hybridity as a kind of leading point, I just wanted to ask Joey how some of the discussions came about for the development of Ophius in terms of this interdisciplinary conversation between yourself and Catherine and Marco.
I mean, I guess like I have Wising to thank for that in the outset, because I had this interest in the deep sea and the weird creatures that live there, and then I also had this interest in kind of like this idea that we can map and take this data from like the far reaches of the earth and create like data sets for this, and like specifically in genetics as well. So I guess like it started with having some conversations with a pair of them, and then like thinking about how these things are kind of related, which at first I guess they didn't feel that related, but now yeah, that seems to have come together somehow. But yeah, I think it's really interesting actually that in these conversations, I mean, I'm not directly answering your question, but that when we first did our presentations, like back at Wising, like last year, it was like kind of very much presenting our own research, and now it's kind of become a lot more responding to what each other have done, like with the work. And I find it really amazing, actually, that Katrin's kind of like, commenting about the project itself, and like, so you kind of have, and Marco as well, so it's kind of like scientists trying to talk about art, and then artists trying to talk about us, trying to talk about science. And actually, I think that they do it really well. And so yeah, this. Sorry, that was like not answering your question.
Well, I was thinking about the way that Ophiux itself is a kind of fictional composite.
Yes.
It's kind of research influencing a fiction.
Yeah.
And so I guess for Marco and Catherine, to what extent is that helpful to your research practice in terms of speculation or the idea that a fiction could kind of influence the way you think about the possibilities of research?
No, I think it's very important, because it's really difficult sometimes, because we're so deep in our work that it's really difficult to see how it is perceived outside of our bubble, let's say. So it's a really interesting concept to be able to work with artists to see how they themselves perceive what science is nowadays with all the different fields and so on. It's really, I think it can be a really, potentially could really give us some more directions, because I think an artist with his or her sensibility would be able to see things, see maybe a bit longer than we are, because we are so obsessed by the details, we don't have the time to look up and see where we are or where we could go. So I think, yeah, I think there is lots of potential in that.
Yeah, I think Joey's work brought us a bit further, because we are still very human-focused. We think we are the crown of the tree of life, or there are a lot of people thinking that. But the Anthropocene has shown what one species can do to change the world we are living in. And what Marco is trying to figure out with his research on how we can manipulate it further. And my research is discovering some freaky animals, and then from that research, everybody knows the alien. And then you can go and take a trawl in midwater and find an amphipod that lives in that area. And suddenly you think, like, this looks like alien. You look at Avatar and think, yeah, deep sea species, so you see where it's inspired. But then Joey came in and developed her idea for Phenox and what it is. And have you seen a human in it? Everything was scanned, the whole DNA is done, and we are in a world where we are isolated. And this is where I think she brings it for me further on saying, hey, be careful what you're doing. Yes, you can manipulate everything, you can find everything, but you don't know whether you want to have the result, having your artificial intelligence suddenly taking over because they are so good that they outreach us.
I think just to add about that as well, it's, I mean, a lot of the discussion has been around, like, I love it that Marco and Katrin often say, like, how much they don't know, and we don't know this, we don't know that, and this kind of admission is really, I find, really great. And I guess, like, in the film, it's this kind of all-seeing eye of this pharmaceutical corporation that sort of claims that it has mapped the marine ecosystem and that it does know all of these things, but that's kind of like not a fiction in a way, for the way that a lot of corporations or pharmaceutical companies often use this kind of language, that they say that they can do these things, but in reality it's maybe not, you know, that the way that it is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the things I was going to ask you both in terms of your research is that you're working with kind of visual materials quite sort of regularly, and in terms of some of the deep sea reconnaissance, I just wondered to what extent there was an aesthetic agenda at play that kind of moulded that material for sort of public exhibition, and to what extent, I mean, your research as well in terms of schematization and data visualization, to what extent, in terms of the working process, there's a kind of almost like a concession to broader public legibility, and at what point that occurs?
Well, I think it depends where you work, and I find it, I'm lucky that I'm a biological scientist and that I am going to an area where I think we discover and we see fantastic animals, and this was the reason why I brought some of them here, because you need to see them to understand them, and you need to bring them out. You can't just have them in your research collection and don't show them. And this is where I think nowadays being now able in the deep sea to get video footage of them, how they behave in the natural world, is something that brings by far more people being interested in them and seeing them. So you should use that material. 100 years ago we didn't have it. We have only had fantastic artists, because back to the artist, because we needed an artist to draw the animals as they were looking when they came back dead on deck. Now we can see how they look alive.
Just extending that slightly, I just wanted to address Katja and Joey on the idea of the circulation of images and whether you work with the image of animals in different contexts, and maybe the kind of labour that you expect those kind of images of animals to perform, what sorts of purposes they serve. Quite frequently, then, with your work specifically, Joey, using kind of social media platforms to disseminate images that are of really peculiar creatures and kinds of things that Katrin's kind of exploiting. And they have a kind of destabilizing function in terms of the way we sort of see them, and it gives us a kind of greater sense of species diversity. But kind of I guess the flip side of that is that the kind of material infrastructure through which those images are circulated is one of like huge anthropogenic impact in terms of server farms and you know, deep sea and communication cables. So I just wondered how you two negotiated this relationship between, say, preservation on the one hand, or this kind of greater awareness of species diversity, and then on the other hand, the tools you're using being things that are, you know, kind of quite impactful or wasteful or where do you stand? It's attention.
Yeah, I mean, I can't pretend that I'm the most environmentally friendly person on the earth. I mean, it is something that I think about. I guess, I mean, going back to what you were saying at first, like this kind of showing of these animals to disable or something, our human-centered kind of way of looking at the world. I mean, I think that is important in showing these, but I think it's also just a kind of sort of saying that these are creatures that share the earth with us, and kind of showing this like this otherworldly, if you like, alien kind of things are here on earth, and they are related to us, and we're entangled with them as well. And I guess like when I use diagrams or maps or charts or like through interfaces as well, like through social media platforms or through web platforms as well, I mean, I see that kind of stuff as being quite limited or something, or we're always seeing it through the same glasses or the same screen or something. So there's this kind of contrast between something completely otherworldly and alien, don't seem to kind of like describe what I want to say, but these completely fantastical things, but then you've got like this kind of like real limiting aspect of just seeing it through through this interface window. I don't think I want to comment about the you know, I use computers and you're like, it is taking a lot of resources. I hope humans die really soon.
No, but I think I see the artistic, you know, part of, like, the artist is sort of more like this little bacteria that kind of cover the surfaces of other beings. They're more like material mats on things rather than disruptors in a sense. Because even just, I asked Katrin, you know, how many hours of footage they have from each mission themselves for going there to research things and save them eventually. And they, you said like maybe several hundred hours from each mission of footage that is on hard drives, that is on, you need cameras to go there. So just even the, within, even forget about art, even within the production of knowledge and this meeting point between us and the deep, there's just a bunch of, you know, there's so much industrial production involved. And the artist is just like, I am just looking at images online, and so the percentage of my impact is much smaller. It's more like this bacteria. It's more like a bacteria. I'm just sitting on top of a giant, you know, the scientific field is the giant, and I'm just sort of sitting on top of it, scraping some stuff, making flowers. in that sense, I don't, like, the impact of my, if, like, sort of artistic activity is maybe much smaller, in the sense of just the amount of data, the amount of energy you burn, you know, not the amount of, just like in the hardware, like, you know, it's just me. I often think that it's a sort of artistic practice, it's just like a weird, it's like a mini factory, but it's just so small, yeah, compared to the big real industries.
Yeah. Yeah. Marco, maybe you could kind of continue that through into the idea of computational genetics. I don't know what scale you work on, but could you just describe something of the breadth of that practice and what the infrastructure entails?
So as I was describing, especially in humans, so there is of course lots of focus on medical applications of all these methods, and especially the statistical ones. And we're getting to a point where we probably can envision a future where every newborn will have some sort of genetic testing attached to birth or something similar. And that means lots and lots of data. It's really, the scale is really, big. So as they were saying, it's really, we used to think of digital material as ethereal, but it's very physical in the end. So it's really, it's a challenge, but in a good and a bad way. So where do we store all this data? Do we need to store all this data? And if we need to, how? So it's really an unprecedented scale.
I guess one of the other things that I wanted to kind of come back to, and this is a theme that kind of comes up in your work quite frequently, Joe, just this idea of conspiracy or the idea that these kind of conglomerations or, pharmaceutical identities have a kind of claim to legitimacy or like make a claim to truth, but possibly, aren't the most trustworthy bodies. And I just wondered, in terms of the kind of research tools that Katrin and Marco are using, whether or not there's a kind of wariness of things like, for example, Google Genomics and the kind of promise that that kind of industry makes, whether or not there's also, in terms of the accuracy of research, a kind of encrypted bias that you have to be aware of in terms of, I guess it applies more to your field, but also just in terms of the machines that you're using, the kind of reconnaissance vehicles. How do you kind of gauge your relationship as a researcher with the kind of commercial market, and how is that mediated?
I think we are coming there from two completely different ends, because how I see Marco's research doing, it's almost towards the commercial or research medical market.
Sure.
It would be then used. While I said for us, we developed for research the remote operating vehicles, for example, ISIS that you saw going down on this umbilical cord to take a look at the deep sea animals, take a couple of them. And then the UK has one 6,000 meter rated remote operating vehicle for research. Think about how many oil companies we have in the UK. They are top spot in the world, and they have dozens or hundreds of those ROVs. And research gets the technologies there from the industries, and especially the military. But those guys are high ranking, they have the most modern technologies, and then when it's seen as safe and not specialized anymore, it's fed down to research. Well, I think in some cases, you are developing the high, most modern tools that are then being used further.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really, I think it also relates to the way people ask for money for research. You always have to find the application angle, the something that would make it look like it could be translated to something, either commercial or medical in our case, and so on. I wanted to ask if it, is it the same for you? Do you have to, when you write, when you apply for money for to do research, do you have to put that angle out as well, or it's more?
Yes, we should say where is the impact? Is there a business potential impact, which in some research you can do? In my case, I'm working in the Antarctic in the Southern Ocean, and there's something called Antarctic Treaty, which is protecting the Southern Ocean and the Antarctic from every commercial, from mining, from fisheries, from... So, for example, I'm not allowed to take the bacteria off the kiva and give it to a pharmaceutical company. I would breach the Antarctic Treaty that I signed as a researcher to study. So this is why the Antarctic deep sea species, we can't do that. If I work anywhere else, if I work on... Loki's Castle is different. Loki's Castle is coming onto Norwegian, right? But if you work on a hydrothermal vent that is far away in the open ocean, there's no country protecting it, and then you can come in and do potentially what you like, and then you would be seen as saying, yes, can you put a business angle into it, or an impact angle, and the impact often they would like to have innovation coming out and companies coming out that contribute to the money in the UK.
I watched this one talk about hydrothermal vent research by this news Geographic Society of UK or something like that in London, and then there was this scientist who worked for Shell and he's doing the deep sea vent research, and he just said it very clearly. There's always the development of the mining industry is the thing that also gives you the money for your research. And so there's this super insane line that you have to walk between, like, that enables you to do research, but then also at the same time it will potentially destroy everything you're researching. And it's very schizophrenic. I mean, it's somehow, and it's a real thing.
I just have a question for Joey and Catherine. Just in relation to the submersible footage. And I just wonder if you could explain something of the backstory of how you came into kind of acquiring that footage, Joey, and how, I know that within the kind of image circulation sort of networks that artists use, there's a different kind of approach to like the legitimacy and the kind of copywriting. And I just wonder if you could kind of break that down, because there are different kind of currencies at play, like different kind of value systems and claims to authorship and legitimate sort of acknowledgement of an identity that it's, you know, branded with. So.
Yeah, the RV footage that I showed as well as and Joey used was taken on the CESO consortium grant. So CESO stands for the Hemosynthetic Environments in the Southern Ocean, which was a research grant we put in 2004 or 2005 to the National Environmental Research Council in the UK. So we received 7 universities the research grant to do this work, which is funded by the government, funded by the taxpayers. So exactly the same as the Arts Council. And this is for me, this is a non-commercial use of that footage. It's widening the knowledge of the footage, of the information we did, and it's going into another side of governmentally funded art research culture. So that is fine, because it's acknowledged as my acknowledgement, it's acknowledged this work, it's fine. If then other footage that was pre-used or pre-changed is different, it's under the Freedom of Information Act, a type of footage can be, I think, asked for. The raw one, not worked on. So, and because this is not being commercially sold, there's no problem.
Yeah, I always remember back to our initial conversation there when we first met, because obviously artists have quite a not as strict a kind of referencing of the material. I mean, both Katia and I probably appropriate images from online, and then we're not necessarily going to say where these images came from. And
fair use sort of idea.
Yeah, I mean, I would also say that goes for my own stuff as well. People can use that, and I'm not worried if they don't reference me or something. But yeah, I always remember our first conversation where we talked a lot about copyrights and because some of the footage that I'd used previously from other deep sea explorations, I think you recognised some of the footage, and I just kind of stole it from online. And so we had this kind of really quite a difficult conversation at first about copyright, and but it was quite nice how I guess we got to understand each other a bit better as it went on, and then we did our respective talks at Wising, and then Catherine said, you know, you can use this footage, like, you know, it's yours after, not mine, but, you know, it's yours, you know, feel free to use it after this kind of conversation at first, so.
Yeah.
because it's now also from my side, as Mark said, when we write research grants, we're being asked to say what is the impact, how we get it to the public. We also then, after receiving a grant, every year for about the next 10 years, need to do something and say, what have we done? And we need to show what we have done in our research outputs, our papers, our findings, but also we are asked, did we give any public talks? Were we using any of this? Is any of our footage used in school talks? In our, and so I can use Joey and her multiverse in Orpheos in my research office saying, yes, we contributed. This pay, taxpayers' funds has been multiple used. It was not just being given to one group of 12 scientists to use it and then keep it in the ivory tower. It's actually used and promoted. That is, I think, a very nice use. And I think it's really nice. We had it, I was had the pleasure to be at the naming, the key laying ceremony of the new UK's new polar research vessel a week ago in Liverpool. And for one of the trailers there, they wanted to show an ROV that was filmed from the outside, but we don't have that as our UK ROV because we only have one to film. But if that is filming, it can't film itself. So there was some footage used from an American, from HUI, an American institute in Woods Hole. And so they had to acknowledge the institute because they are keen that there's acknowledgement to them. You can use it, but you just need to acknowledge them.
Mm-hmm. I think we've got time to open up for questions if people want to ask anything.
Partly on what Cassie said about the artist as this kind of bacterial scraper in the world. I just wonder if in the panel in general, if you think there is a role for essentially for artists to be more integrated into, for example, scientific or even industrial research, to take a role which is less goal directed and more kind of hybrid interdisciplinary. Well, of course that also puts some responsibility on artists to actually learn about this stuff, you know, and be interested and bring their skills to that. But I think, you know, we could see more of this. Is there a possibility? Is there even like any, what's the attitude of the scientific community?
I think there, as Marcus said earlier, we need to ask on how we get our research results into the public, and there are various ways, and there are various research institutions that also have art programs. There have been, in the marine field, for example, that I know, various institutions that had artists in residence at different times. But I think at the moment, we are all living in a slightly drier getting area where research and art funding is getting lower and lower. So when you are flourishing, your institutions are happier to widen out and extend that and making positions. Well, now when it's getting harder to get your own research, it's closing down, which doesn't mean that the researchers are closing down to share information. And it's from both sides, I think. The artists need to approach the researchers. And yet Joey was lucky, potentially, on finding some that said, yes, we're interested, we take it up. She might have had some that said, oh, no, I'm not interested. So it's go and ask. And in my case, it would be if I'd be interested to have a specific type of art being presented, I could find an artist, but I must say I would find it weird to go to an artist and say, please, can you do some art about my research? Because for me, art is free thinking, so I don't want to get an idea of my concepts in. The artist should come with their ideas. So I think from my perspective, it's the artist coming actively to the industrial technologies and to the research.
Yeah, maybe I can also expand a bit. So I think that there is a wider appetite now in the public for knowing what the modern science is all about. So there are lots of journalists that are writing very popular columns, books about various scientific subjects that are very wide, actually. It's not only medical applications. So I think I'm quite optimistic for the future, so there would be more and more ways to get this information out. But I would say that any additional way for this information to flow should be welcomed, because it's very easy to get stuck into academic bubbles and not acknowledging what's going on outside of that.
Just to reiterate what he was saying, really, I think about that a lot. Like, I mean, it doesn't matter whether it's an art specialism or a science specialism. There is, I worry a lot about, this kind of academic setting that you're in, and when you're a specialist in something, you go down these kind of tunnels of, like, specialist research, which quite often you only talk to your peers that know about that very specific research, and that, I think, should be opened up through collaborations with people with other disciplines and with these conversations. And I think it's also important that the artist or the scientist or whoever doesn't just go in and kind of like just have an idea and then make some response to that. I think it's also about time that you spend like having these conversations and investing in those conversations over longer periods of time and building up relationships. Well, as with anything, obviously, but that's important as well, to understand where each other is coming from. It's not going to be like an instant thing. Just to invest in that.
Like, for example, something that happened with the Rosetta mission, which is the European Space Agency mission to this comet, is that they made all the HD images from the mission public with this sort of request that they can be used by everybody, and especially by artists. And I made a bunch of sculptures with these images a couple years ago, and then like a month ago, I got an email from the European Space Agency. I was like, oh, now we're sort of collecting kind of an archive of all the artworks that were made with these images, and we're going to store it, and we're going to sort of present it. So it's like, I think this issue of footage is like a very, somehow, if you're making this footage available or your data somehow available, there's people just jump on it, and there's sort of organically something happens, which is just like, it's a very simple step. It's not very resource, the only resource you have is like somebody has to upload everything. You know, each Mars rover returns millions of images. There's so much stuff, even on that simple level of files. And of course, it's not a dialogue, but it's an entanglement. Yeah.
So I was just thinking about this quite optimistically about the future. So I was thinking about your problems with data storage, and this is kind of always the option for kind of encrypting data within DNA, which is kind of something that links quite nicely to the talk. And then something else I wanted to briefly say about, which was the kind of similarities between space exploration and undersea exploration. And I was wondering about the kind of how this, you're talking about how this information is just got out into the world. And there's, I think, space has been quite kind of successful. Again, kind of everybody's very enthusiastic about space, whereas maybe less so to do with undersea. And I was wondering whether that is possibly has something to do with kind of undersea is still kind of categorized as kind of natural history and kind of put into a natural history world, whereas space has kind of, it's got many much more kind of populist kind of films and all sorts of stuff. And so I was thinking along the lines of what kind of other ways of kind of breaking out of the traditional approach to show undersea research, could there be, and whether it maybe is not best suited to a museum, whether it's best suited to these videos, maybe online or whatever kind of methods. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Could I just respond just quickly to the idea of like the sort of genetic encryption of data? Are you talking about like the body as a kind of repository for knowledge, or what's it? Oh, okay, for, okay, that's right. Yeah, sorry, I just had an aside, but it's okay.
Yeah, I just think you nailed it really well with your comment on why deep sea research in the past hasn't get the same attention as space research, because then if you go to the deep sea, you can find it all, and then you don't know what else is there. So all your imagination ends at one point, while in space, you can bring anything in that you like, because you know it's endless. You can never be proven wrong, in my view, because it's, yeah. It's big. And I think the physicists from a long time ago have used very successful tools on getting the interest of the public, on the media, on Hollywood. I think deep sea research is picking up. I think I'm like you, seeing positively into the future.
Yeah, it's a lot about like it's Hollywood tactics, and just NASA has a bigger budget for public relationships. It's really a lot about budgets in the end.
I think a lot though about, I mean, the thinking that the space is endless, or like you can make up anything and it keeps going. But then, like you were saying, there's so much that we don't know about our own world right here. And like every, it seems like there's a different scientific story every day or something that transforms our like perception of what life could be. And like, especially in the deep sea, these creatures are, don't need light, they don't need oxygen, they're using a whole other use of energy that seems kind of completely alien. And I think that like what is here on Earth is everything. There's every kind of possibility still here that we haven't discovered, that is, I think, the main point of this as well.
Yeah, I think what I find interesting is that the new technologies that are being thought about being developed for the deep sea, which in areas that we are currently limited to research, are now being designed together with NASA, with ESA, with the space agencies. As Katja said, yeah, some of the areas with Europa where they think it's marine, suddenly they say, oh yeah, maybe we can work together, and maybe problems you have we might be able to solve, because we are thinking of developing a rover in this way that can work in deep water, and we then would need to test it in the deep. Would you be interested in developing it with us? But yeah, so it's starting, but again, it's a space industry with a lot of money over the last 100 years.
Any other questions at all?
I just wondered if any of you were involved in any big campaigns against sort of tackling some of the issues you talked about.
As in,
against the mining or fishing industry, the sort of effect they're having on the deep sea.
As in direct action or like activism?
Yeah, activism. Yeah.
No, I'm not joined any activism. We had tried to get research funding for research on the effects of the deep sea mining, to find an idea how is the ecosystem will be affected, what is the result of it, because on both sides we can say yes, you will destroy it, and then they might turn around and say no, you're not. And with the hydrothermal vent sites, we have some that we know aside one of those cones might only live for 30 years and then it moves 100 meters. And this is why they are thinking of, they would take some of the extinct chimneys out. But then we have some other chimneys that take hundreds or thousands of years to form, and we don't know where these are yet. And this is where we should think, before we start destroying something, we You need to learn about how the different areas are. It's not one forest is not like the other forest. We all now, after hundreds of years of research, know that the Amazon forest is very special because it has so much special species and takes so much carbon up. But it has been a long, long time of finding out of that, and we're still destroying it. Now we are complaining, and now for the deep sea, we're starting a step further behind because we don't even know what systems we have and how old they grow and how fast they grow. This is where, But there are complaints and there are research talking actively with the mining companies on what you can do before you destroy it. There is talk going on, but not on the activism level of going onto the streets and complaining, but there is a lot of work going on behind the scenes, more quietly, with the politicians, with the businesses. And
so there is a dialogue.
There is a dialogue. There are conferences, the House of Lords in last December had a big open debate about the issue, so it's going on. It's not that it's not sort out.
Yeah, I think we'll stop it there. Thank you, Jamie. And actually, we're not finished here yet because Joey and I, we thought that, you know, it would be really interesting that Jamie, he somehow ended the day with a plenary presentation. Took the day a bit in another direction, maybe more through a kind of fix.
I just don't know
we're
doing that,
Jamie.
Yeah.
Do you still want to do
it?
I'd really like to do it.
Yeah, I could do it. I'm sitting like that again. I could sort of blitz through a few of the ideas.
That would be great.
Yeah.